This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Today, I will continue to read about the freshwater eel, Anguillidae. There are more than 16 species in the world, and they have confounded scientists for centuries trying to figure out where they come from and where they go and where do they breed. In the last three programs, I have read from the book Eels, An Exploration from New Zealand to the Sargasso of the World's Most Mysterious Fish, published in 2010 by James Prosek. If you haven't heard earlier programs, go to the archive podcasts on WDRT.org and look for the Natural Wonders program. I'll be reading parts of Chapter 4, More Tales of Taniwha. We're in New Zealand, where the largest of the freshwater eels live. And then I pivot to a parallel subject in New Zealand to hear in the driftless area streams and a good change that might be on the horizon here. And then I will pivot back to more of Chapter 4 and we'll go back to the freshwater eels. This is James Prosek. It is hard to see freshwater eels in their habitat. Oftentimes, they live in murky water, are active mostly at night, and flee if approached. It is an unusual character trait of the New Zealand eels that they come out willingly to feed during the day and can be found in rivers and streams that are crystal clear. This offers a good opportunity to observe them in their element. I had brought some snorkeling gear and told Stella I was determined during our trip to watch eels underwater. After visiting Kelly, we returned to the North Island. Stella said she knew a good place to see big eels on our way back north to Napier and her family farm, and that I could try out my snorkeling gear there. Standing on a bridge, peering into the creek at Mount Bruce Wildlife Preserve, I watched Stella toss mackerel chunks into the water to coax the eels out from the undercut banks. As the huge eels came out from the dark shadows, I was stunned by their enormousness, their sleek, mysterious movements. "Having second thoughts?" Stella asked. I walked carefully down the steep, muddy bank to the creek and eased into the frigid currents, wearing a mask and snorkel and wetsuit. As I swam among the big eels, they came up to me and bumped their noses against my mask. It was hard not to flinch as one approached, torquing its muscular body, thick as the calf of my leg and close to 5 feet long. How to define it? Was it an ocean fish or a river fish? At that size, bigger than an average large salmon, it felt to me more like an ocean fish. Yet how much history it had with the land, the seasons, the storms, the farm animals, the stones and leaves, the bird songs, the insects, the daily cycle of the sun, things tangible to us. In the ocean, it was capable of traveling in the aphotic zone, at depths where no light penetrates. How did it navigate? The eel's motion in the pool at Mount Bruce Creek was beautiful, lyrical, sinuous, symmetrical, but also fearsome. It was a sacred moment being in the water, body fully immersed with them. And now a little bit further into this chapter, we meet a character named DJ, a Maori bush guide who resembles a cross between a cowboy and an Indian. Daniel Joe is tall and lean, with a long nose and a casual swagger. He wears a silver pocket watch in a leather pouch. Wristwatches, he says, get hung up in the bush, and a pig hunting knife in its sheath, side by side on his belt. They're cooking some trout on the grill. DJ poked the fire with a stick. The flames illuminated the strong angles of his face. The way I see it, there are three players in the river. The rainbow trout, the brown trout, and the eel, he began. The trout are British imports. The eel is the cultural factor. Everyone forgets about the eel because you don't see them. You don't see the eel, but he's there. and he's relentless in his efforts to catch the trout. He's always stalking them. Ultimately, he's the survivor. He can take the other two out any time. He might wait years to catch them, till they get old and weak. The eel, he's got time. He's been there before the trout, and he'll be there after. We call that morehu, the survivor. I liken that to our present situation in New Zealand, DJ continued. Between the Maori people and the crown, the Maori people now are the morehu. We're in pursuit of correcting the wrong that the crown brought to us. Stella and the ones who are getting educated in the universities, they are told by their elders, like I was told by mine, that we have to fight. Our land is our economy, and the last foothold is the foreshore and the seabed. They want to make it legal through legislation to take those rights from us. DJ paused to drink some wine. Hey there, Stella, he said to her. Her long black hair looked especially dark this night. Stella responded with a sedate, yeah. I looked at the largest of the trout, its flesh a beautiful orange-gold color. Back home, this trout would have been a trophy. Here, trout this large are commonplace. Ironically, while the large size of New Zealand trout could be attributed to a rich food supply and mild winters, another contributing factor was the eel. The acclimatization society was correct to think that the eel was a predator of the trout. Eels eat plenty of them, but in the years that the eradication efforts continued, and anglers and society members killed thousands of large eels, they saw their trophy trout fishery change. The trout in eel-free rivers had become more numerous, yes, but the average size was much smaller. In the 1950s, a biologist named Max Burnett, studying the interaction of trout and eels in the streams of Canterbury, discovered that the eel, maligned and needlessly slaughtered, was actually in part responsible for the now world-famous trout fishing in New Zealand. By preying on the trout, the eel was culling a population that soon became overpopulated and stunted without them. With the eels in the rivers, the trout were fewer but much larger. Burnett's work showed that the presence of eels was beneficial and single-handedly turned around public opinion of them. The killing stopped. I'm going to stop reading eels and interrupt the reading because there's a parallel situation here in the Driftless area with our trout streams, lack of predators, or fisher people. I'm going to read a letter to the editor that an old friend of mine, Roger Kerr, has been writing in one form or another many times over the decades. He's a fisheries biologist, now retired, who was alarmed to see the reduction in the number of people fishing for trout in our driftless streams. His letter explains the history of what he saw and what he wanted to do about it. This is Roger Kerr. This letter is about trout fishing and management in southwest Wisconsin. 50 years ago, the opening day of trout fishing in southwest Wisconsin in May was a cultural event comparable to the opening of gun deer season in November. Anglers would camp out on streams the Friday before the Saturday opening and start fishing as soon as it was light enough to bait a hook. Streams like the Big Green River in northern Grant County would have 400 anglers at 8 a.m. on the opening morning. There was so much concern about all the crowding that occurred with 400 anglers on one stream like the Big Green that a decision was made to change the opening day in 8 counties in southwest Wisconsin to January 1 to spread out trout fishing activity. This started in 1975. Early fishing in these counties proved to be very popular. April became the number one trout fishing month. Intensive monitoring of trout populations in the early season area showed that trout were just as abundant with 9-month fishing as with 5-month fishing. Anglers from all over Wisconsin and neighboring states spent 20 years coming to southwest Wisconsin to fish trout early. Starting in 1990, the Wisconsin DNR began changing trout rules in Wisconsin that turned off bait fishing keep-and-eat anglers. Tens of thousands of these anglers quit trout fishing due to these rule changes. There has been no recovery from this severe decline. The changes that were made were as follows. 1. Trout rules went from a few words to 32 pages. Around 1,000 streams and lakes were given special rules. Bag limits were lowered. 2. The DNR terminated early fishing in 1994, even though there was no biological reason to stop this season. 3. A new early statewide season was created in 1996, but bait was prohibited and harvest was prohibited. A lot of people, including me, complained about the very negative impact these changes had on trout fishing activity. We were ignored. Around 2000, the DNR began wild trout stocking. Hundreds of streams in southwest Wisconsin were stocked with wild brown trout, and most of these streams quickly developed abundant brown trout populations. By 2006, trout were 20 times more abundant in southwest Wisconsin than they were in 2000. Did the DNR make any significant rule changes in southwest Wisconsin to respond to this dramatic transformation of the area trout resource? The answer is no. We critics complained about this too. Again, we were ignored. Well, it appears that the DNR has had an epiphany. They will have two significant rule change proposals for trout on their agenda for the spring hearings to be held on April 8th in every Wisconsin county. Spring hearings are for the purpose of discussing and voting on proposed fish and game rule changes. The trout rule changes will be terminating the 3-bag and 8-inch size limit and adding April to the harvest season. There is an online option to attending the spring hearings. Anyone can vote on fish and game rule changes from their home if they have a computer. To do this, enter dnr.wi.gov in your computer and look for the DNR Spring Hearings webpage, which shows the rule change proposals. Online voting will be from 12 noon April 10th to 12 noon April 13th. I encourage all persons who want better trout management here in southwest Wisconsin and participate in the spring hearings to vote yes on these two trout regulation change proposals. And that's what my friend Roger Kerr wrote. Those dates to vote online, again, are 12 noon April 10th to 12 noon April 13th on the DNR website. Look for the spring hearings part. I'll continue and divert back to reading the book Eels by James Prosek. And this is part of Chapter 5, The First Taste of Fresh Water. In late winter, about mid-March, when plates of ice still line the muddy banks of tidal creeks, baby eels are just making their way from the sea into freshwater streams of southern New England. At this time of year in New Zealand and other parts of the southern hemisphere, their autumn, adult eels are beginning to migrate to the sea to spawn. From Little Compton, Rhode Island, to Manhattan Island, tiny fish, small as matchsticks and clear as glass, ascend the estuaries and lagoons invisibly, moving from salt to fresh. A year or so before, between February and April, these fish were hatched from eggs in the Sargasso Sea. They drifted and fed and grew in the rich seawater, sheltered in their early days in thick mats of sargassum weed and by their transparency. Riding currents flowing to the west, the first eels entered estuaries and freshwater rivers of the Caribbean islands about November. By January, larvae were making their way into the Gulf of Mexico and toward the east coast of Florida. Subsequently, they reached estuaries and bays of the Carolinas and Virginia and Maryland. By March, April, and May, the rivers of southern New England, Maine, and Canada were receiving their manna, including the stream that connects the sea to the pond across the street from my home in Connecticut. The ocean spawning location is strategic at the head of a particular current, a river in the sea, which ensures that the hatchlings will be carried back toward the coast. how the young eels know to move west out of the ocean river to enter the freshwater rivers of North America is a mystery. If they didn't, they would continue riding the North Atlantic drift like corks in a river. And how some eels enter a given river and others move on to populate different rivers, distributing themselves more or less evenly throughout the range, is also a mystery. By the time the eels first enter fresh water from the sea, they have slimmed from their leaf-shaped larval stage, though they are still totally transparent except for two black dots for eyes. The glass eels move up the estuaries at night on the incoming tide, largely unnoticed by humans as they swim past, under and around our businesses, homes, dams, and bridges. Days after entering fresh water, the clear fish become pigmented, like thin black shoelaces, at which point they're called elvers. The juveniles feed and grow and become resident eels in an estuary, river, or lake, occupying a particular place for 10 to 100 years, depending on the species. At this stage, they are sometimes referred to as yellow eels because they are usually yellow-brown to olivaceous in color. When they are of age to migrate and spawn, they undergo physiological changes that prepare them for their long sea journeys. Their eyes get bigger and take on a bluish cast. Their skin becomes thicker, and their pectoral fins elongate. Steel-colored with black backs like many ocean fishes, these migrating eels, fat and strong, are referred to by biologists and fishermen alike as silver eels. Eels once traveled up the Mississippi and tributaries as far as Iowa, Ohio, Minnesota, and Illinois, in numbers significant enough to support commercial fisheries. In New England, old-timers talk of slicks or rafts of glass eels moving up tidal creeks in spring, so thick they formed mats on top of the water to overcome obstacles such as vertical walls or waterfalls. They would form braids with their bodies, a phenomenon known by old Mainers as roping up. These days, an eel caught in the Midwest is an aberration, and many say that such huge runs of glass eels don't happen anymore. The range of the American eel is shrinking, the total population declining. While some attribute it to habitat loss and pollution, others blame a commercial export fishery for glass eels to Asia that developed in the late 70s, but did not hit its peak until the mid-1990s, an event that fishermen and conservation officers alike refer to as the eel gold rush. The international trade in eels, a multi-billion-dollar industry, is driven largely by Japan's appetite for the rich, fatty flesh. The eel trade remains dependent on the capture of wild fish, because no one has figured out how to reproduce eels in captivity in an economically viable way. In the early 1990s, the population of native eels in Japan, Anguilla japonica, began to nosedive, and prices for eel became prohibitively high. Asian dealers started to look elsewhere to meet the demand, and soon found that similar freshwater eel species lived in Europe and North America. Europe had existing fisheries for eels, mostly for the adults, with several historical eel fishing centers, like the Skane region of southern Sweden and Basque regions of France and Spain, Camaccio, Italy, and Loch Ness, Ireland, to name a few. Once cherished by Native Americans and early white settlers, one of the first things Squanto taught the pilgrims of Plymouth Colony was to fish for eels. The eel had been largely ignored as a food fish in modern America. This made North America, even more than Europe, a perfect target for export to Asia. Eels were plentiful, and there were no limits on how many could be taken. One issue that had to be overcome was getting the eels from North America or Europe to Japanese markets alive, since very often they are killed, dressed, and prepared all at once in eel-only restaurants. Instead of shipping adult eels, which was costly because of the shipping weight, dealers focused on the capture of glass eels, which could be shipped by the millions to warehouse-style farms in China and Taiwan, where they are fattened. Another advantage of farming eels from the juvenile stage is that the fish can be raised to the preferred size, about 18 inches, so that a single eel, halved, splayed, grilled, and served over a bed of rice, will fit into a black lacquered box with a red interior, a dish called unagi. I'll stop here. I've been reading from Eels, an Exploration from New Zealand to the Sargasso of the World's Most Mysterious Fish by James Prosek. He spells his last name P-R-O-S-E-K. I thank him so much for his permission to read from his book. And if you love trout, he's written and illustrated beautiful books on trout. He's also published many more books. There's a dizzying amount of information online about the commercial exploitation of eels, mostly in their glass and elver stages, to feed the insatiable Asian market. The Japanese eels have been depleted, so the pressure is on in other populations around the world to meet the demand, including here in the United States. Because a kilo of glass eels value is approaching $5,000, there's a vigorous worldwide illegal trade in glass eels and elvers heading to Asian warehouse-style farms, many of which wind up back here in our U.S. restaurants and shops. Another major problem with this trade is that the eels are taken before they ever have a chance to reproduce. If you love Japanese food, please make a point of not eating eels. Unagi. Please do listen to the first three broadcasts of this series on eels. I know you will enjoy learning about these amazing fish and hearing Prosek's beautiful writing. I can't stop reading this book now. I've got another program coming up next week. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.